Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for May 7th. Up first is Amalatar Guzman, writing on why Anaida Polyev is the Conservative Party's secret weapon.
On September 10th, 2022, after the Conservative Party leadership race results were announced and the winner was declared, I didn't necessarily plan on watching Pierre Polyev's speech. It was obvious he would win. Nevertheless, I am glad I decided to check it out, and not because of Pierre. I hadn't expected to see something completely new burst onto the Canadian political stage, and yet I did. That something new came in the form of Anaida Polyev, a Venezuelan-Canadian introducing her husband as the next leader of one of Canada's oldest political parties. She immediately grabbed my attention as she began her speech. She spoke about how her family left Venezuela, arrived in Canada as refugees, and settled in a working-class neighborhood in East Montreal in the mid-90s. Her father, formerly a bank manager back home, worked in Canada jumping on the back of a pickup truck to collect fruits and vegetables to provide for the family. Eventually, he became a small business owner, and she and her siblings went on to make lives for themselves. Her experiences were relatable to me, and the more than a million other Canadians who grew up in Latin American households, whose families immigrated and settled in Canada for a better, secure life. But that wasn't the only interesting thing about Anaida's speech. Not only was it in Canada's two official languages of English and French, she also spoke in Spanish, a language that is rarely heard on any major Canadian political stage. Her tone, rhetoric, and storytelling technique also sounded so familiar to me. This was not a quintessential Canadian speech. It was a Latin American one. In just 4 minutes, Anaida stole the room. I was no longer looking at Pierre. Some Latin American Canadians, especially Venezuelan Canadians, of which there are approximately 20,000, responded positively to Anaida's performance. For many, it was the first time they felt heard and seen in Canadian politics. Afterward, when Anaida appeared on Quebec's TVA program Le Bilan, Le Journal de Montréal's Yasmine Abdelfadel commented that she is self-confident, intelligent, and passionate. She concluded that Anaida's story is of an accomplished Quebecois of Venezuelan origin that could become La Prochaine Dame of Canada. It became obvious then that her triple identity as a Canadian Quebecois of Venezuelan, alongside her professional experience, makes her a potent political asset for the Conservatives and a threat to the Liberal government, which often paints the Tories as anti-immigrant. She was an intriguing new voice in our public life. Now that polls show the Conservatives are favored to win the next federal election, we could not only have the first ever Latin American Canadian spouse of a prime minister, but also the first one who arrived here as a refugee. It is time to consider what having Anaida Polyev in that role may mean to Canadians and public policy at large. Her speeches, interviews, and political ads tend to cover certain themes like social and economic mobility and meritocracy that appeal to conservative voters. The foundation of her rhetoric is something not really seen before in Canadian politics, but it is widely known amongst us Spanish-speaking Latin Americans. It's called Ponte las pilas. The literal definition is put on your batteries, but its figurative meaning is get it together. Don't give up, work harder, or keep pushing forward. It's much more than a motto you would see on a Spanish-language tote bag. It is a promise. The idea is that despite all the challenges we face, we will overcome them. We will not let anything or anyone hold us back, and we will ultimately get to a place where we are not just surviving but thriving. As Anaida said on the Latin American Canadian program TLN Connects, we Latin American Canadians don't want to be given any handouts. We want to get ahead on our own merits and want the opportunities to get ahead. This mentality is not without its criticism. Some say it can breed toxic positivity and be used to even invalidate mental health challenges. Still, others find it aspirational. It's a perspective that could be enticing to the conservative base, but also potential voters. In times of political and socioeconomic malaise, Ponte las pilas could be seen as an antidote, especially for younger Canadians who are currently the least happy demographic in Canada. How Anaida's presence could highlight Canada's Latin American community remains to be seen. Some Venezuelan Canadians believe she will make a difference. A man named Carlos, interviewed by New Canadian Media, said that while he had never heard of Ineta before, and he does not generally align with the Conservative Party, her speech moved him to tears. "I felt very identified as an immigrant. I identified 100%, he said. Others are not convinced Ineta's presence will change much. Cristina Pulido Vielma, a Venezuelan-Canadian interpreter also interviewed by New Canadian Media, noted that when she signed up for a Canadian politics course for the Latin American-Canadian community, conservatives did not participate. She criticized the party's lack of Latin American-Canadian outreach. All the federal parties, except the conservatives, sent guest speakers. This shows how little they cared about making us part of their movement, she said. Now that Mr. Polyev has a Venezuelan wife, it might make a difference to some, but I don't think it will make any difference to others. Canada's Latin American community, typically hailing from places like Mexico, Central and South America, and the Caribbean, sits at just over 1 million people, representing 3.3% of the population as of 2021. While it has experienced considerable growth in the past several years, it is much smaller than the United States' whopping 62.5 million Latin Americans, accounting for 19% of their population that same year. These demographics matter. Latin American Canadians don't carry anywhere near the same political weight as their American cousins, whose votes have the power to make or break presidential elections. Canadian governments don't feel that pressure to understand the Latin American Canadian community, explained Anna Karina Rizzo, a Venezuelan-Canadian lawyer and president of Ladies of Liberty Alliance Canada, in an interview with The Hub. The community's political representation is minuscule. Minister of Transport Pablo Rodriguez is the first and currently only Latin American Canadian MP in a cabinet position and in the House of Commons. Across Canada, there are no serving Latin American Canadian politicians at the provincial and territorial levels of government, with the exception of Alejandra Ziga Mendez and Andres Fontesilla in Quebec. Because of this, certain inequities are underreported and under the radar. While there is limited research, studies have shown that Latin American Canadians are lagging behind other ethnic groups in terms of wages and education. In Toronto, because they were more likely to work in frontline jobs during the pandemic, they were 7 times more likely to be hospitalized from COVID-19 than any other ethno-racial group. Most troubling, they had the second highest mortality rate among immigrant communities affected by the virus. Latin American Canadians' political participation is, however, generally quite high. Nearly 85% of eligible Latin American Canadians voted in the 2019 federal election, according to Statistics Canada. The community's political views are varied and diverse. Some, having left countries ruled by socialist regimes, feel ideologically drawn to the Conservative Party. Others associate it with the U.S. Republican Party and automatically assume it is anti-immigrant, Rizzo explains. Even though Latin American Canadians tend not to get deeply involved in Canadian politics outside of voting, in large part because they view it as stable compared to Latin American politics, Rizzo says that the tides are changing. With rising inflation, healthcare challenges, high housing prices, and broader affordability issues looming, Latin American Canadians may be mobilized to run for political office themselves. As you have more issues, people are feeling more invested to get involved, explains Rizzo. One Latin American Canadian who will no doubt be involved is Ineta. While spouses of Canadian prime ministers hold no official title or office, they do accompany their spouse abroad and meet other world leaders, give speeches, and most importantly can use their position to champion causes. For example, Sophie Gregoire Trudeau focused on mental health issues and eating disorders during her time by Justin Trudeau's side. Ineta has mentioned that she would focus on women's issues, immigration, and, most strikingly, human trafficking. Overall, Ineta's presence in federal politics will surely bring new energy and influence to the Conservatives, helping to attract and energize not only Latin American Canadians but other immigrant groups more broadly to see themselves at home in the CPC. And if my experience watching her a couple of years ago is illustrative, we'd be wrong to dismiss her.
That was a commentary by Amal Attar Guzman. She is the Hub's content editor. You can find the full text of her article on our website, thehub.ca. Our second essay is by Ginny Roth, writing on why isolationists are naive and wrong, asking why are we afraid to actually engage them?
I was born at the end of history. No, really. My mother gave birth to me on October 20, 1989. The Berlin Wall fell 20 days later and the Ceausescu were executed 46 days after that. So sped up the falling apart of the Soviet Union and the winding down of the decades-long Cold War that defined our parents' youth. By the time my peers and I were in school, post-Cold War optimism was reaching a fever pitch. It seems moronically naive now to suggest that the mere fact of increasing global wealth and democracy would stave off geopolitical strife, that since no two countries that both have a McDonald's have ever fought a war against each other, none ever would. And that therefore the job of liberal democracies like Canada and the United States was to push a kind of fast food diplomacy. But at the time, it was gospel. The 1990s were a sweet spot for kids in most Western democracies. We weren't hiding under desks during bomb threats, and smartphones hadn't yet invaded our lives. The Bosnian genocide felt like a blip that mostly went over our heads, and the optimism of the Oslo Accords only enhanced the hubris of increasingly mainstream peaceniks. Then 9/11 happened. A flash of extraordinary evil, to be sure, but who to blame? At first it was enough to promise vengeance, but soon action had to be taken. Afghanistan seemed to make sense. Even though 9/11 was perpetrated by non-state actors, the country was harboring Al-Qaeda, and we needed to get Osama bin Laden. Iraq was a harder circle to square. A difficult truth I learned as a gung-ho contrarian junior high student willing to take up the side in the class debate no one else would volunteer for, and finding myself struggling to justify what was increasingly understood to be a poorly conceived invasion with increasingly high costs. I was 17 years old when the U.S.-Iraq war casualties peaked in 2007. As it happens, J.D. Vance was 23. Of course, I bring up Vance for a reason. The context in which he and our millennial generation grew up is crucial to understanding the concerning rise in varying degrees of isolationism among young right-wing leaders in the U.S., and to a lesser extent Canada. It's tempting to not even try to understand. Far easier, and more gratifying, to call Ukraine war-funding skeptics Putin stooges, useful idiots, and conspiracy theorists, chalking their cynicism up to too much Tucker Carlson. But just because we disagree with them doesn't mean we should dismiss them. Some of these skeptics come by their analysis honestly, informed by a very different upbringing than the neocon boomers who come to their foreign policy hawkishness so easily. Those of us who believe the U.S. and its allies must pursue peace through strength ought to be engaging with the arguments put forward by the young isolationists, particularly those who share some of our first principles. By continuing to talk past one another, we risk winding up on the wrong side of a demographic trend, shaking our fists at the sky as the neocons age out of the public discourse, and America one day soon really does turn inward. The Ukraine funding skeptics are making relatively detailed public policy arguments, as Vance does here in the New York Times. They are ready and willing to be engaged with. And the more prominent among them tend to be ideas politicians, identifying problems caused by previous generations, often in their own party, and putting forward new policy programs to try to solve them. What's striking is that their positions on everything from China to industrial policy to nationalism and strong borders seem to belie their position on Ukraine. Senator Marco Rubio, for instance, voted against the most recent foreign aid package. This despite having fled Cuba, building his career advocating for anti-communist foreign policy, leading his peers on China skepticism, and speaking out against dictatorships the world over. Rubio and his Senate colleague Vance have also prioritized making an argument for a strong industrial policy, often hearkening back to the heyday of America's manufacturing heartland. They advocate for reshoring supply chains and investing in key industries to revitalize sectors that produce well-paying, stable jobs. Indeed, many of the policy thinkers of their intellectual movement point to expanding defense industrial capacity to prepare the U.S. to defend its interests and that of its allies abroad and strengthen the domestic economy. Vance argues in his New York Times essay that the U.S. doesn't have the defense manufacturing capacity to make the number of artillery shells that Ukraine needs. But isn't that just an argument for exactly the kind of industrial policy he and his supporters have been advocating for? Finally, many of the national conservatives who oppose Ukraine funding embrace an old-fashioned patriotism, cultural nationalism, and concern for border sovereignty that lends itself very well to an argument for supporting allies in their own battles for national sovereignty. Indeed, they point to the migrant crisis at America's southern border and the current administration's inadequate response as the main reason they wouldn't support the aid bill. But this very concern for the strength of one's own national borders, for the virtues of one's own domestic population, for the shared values of one's own people, and for the vitality of one's own economy is precisely why wealthy Western countries ought to arm our peer nations who are struggling to preserve exactly those things, especially when the forces that threaten them could very well threaten us next. It's not a leap for the young isolationists to support more aid to Ukraine or Israel or eventually Taiwan, which is why we should try to help them make it. Because of course Fukuyama was wrong. At most, as Barry Weiss puts it, we had but a holiday from history. Now that the holiday's over, it's easier for those who grew up with Ronald Reagan's assertive foreign policy clarity to revert to a posture that worked. But for many millennials, chest thumping about Russia and Iran sounds like a precursor to a quagmire, their minds sending them back to the mess in Iraq, and the foreign aid package dollar figures making them fret about their own economic circumstances. They want to believe that the U.S. and its allies can disengage from the world, letting strong men reign and civilizations fall with no domestic consequences. Our task is explaining the likely consequences of that approach, without disdain or dismissiveness. Yes, even if you think our interlocutors occasionally watch too much Tucker Carlson.
That was a commentary by Ginny Roth. She is the National Practice Lead for Government Relations at Crestview Strategy. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.